This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
But it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You are listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. It's just past 5 p.m. You made it through Wednesday. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is here, but he is currently running to the train station. I'm joined by the wonderful Christine Aquino. She's going to hang out with me throughout the hour. Christine, thank you for joining me.
It is absolutely my pleasure, Alex. I've missed this. I've missed you. I'm glad Guy is heading on a train back home.
Yeah.
It's his loss, really.
Totally agree. We have a lot to get through. So European equity is pretty much closed flat. Euro-dollar pretty much flat. 106 is where we sit. It's all about the Fed, which is going to happen in 2 hours. Then tomorrow, the BOE, as well as the ECB. We did get a couple company stories in today. Watches of Switzerland, those shares were down. The sales may be strong, but it's the margin issues that's plaguing this company. Inditex, same kind of thing. Sales up, but you got rising costs and weakening sentiment from consumers also providing a dicier outlook for the company, which leads us to inflation at lower from a 41-year high. But still, apparently, Christine, you guys drink a lot of whiskey and gin over there.
Oh, yeah.
That's causing a serious price surge.
Especially with the freezing temperatures over the last couple of days, Alex. And I know this is nothing compared to what New Yorkers and Americans in general are used to. We're talking about centimeters of snow. You know, maybe that's like maybe 2 inches, but that's a lot. That's a lot for Brits. We need to cope somehow.
It's true, but thank you for acknowledging that we get snow here. Guy never does that. Anyway, we got a lot to get through this hour. Now let's get some other headlines here with Charlie Pellet.
Hi, thank you very much, Alex Steele. Here's what's going on. A small boat laden with migrants capsized in the dark in the English Channel this morning, killing four and increasing calls on the British government to do more to prevent people from risking their lives trying to cross one of the world's busiest shipping lanes. Helicopters and lifeboats raced from bases in southern England after authorities received reports of a small boat in difficulty in waters between Britain and France just after 3 a.m. The Press Association, citing government sources, said 43 people were rescued, with more than 30 of those pulled from the water. Britain's foreign secretary says China's government has removed a Chinese consul general and five of his staff following the assault on a Hong Kong pro-democracy protester at the Chinese consulate in Manchester. Foreign Secretary James Cleverly said British police wanted to question the six officials over the assault on protester Bob Chen, who said masked men came out from the consulate building during a peaceful protest in October, dragged him into the consulate grounds, and beat him up. Britain's biggest intercity train operator, Avanti West Coast, has been told that its speedy-sounding name had become a bad joke after it clocked up the worst delays of any UK rail firm. A meeting of the House of Commons Transport Committee heard that Avanti, which translates as ahead or onwards in Italian, needs to rethink its branding following a months-long meltdown of services amid a driver shortage. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
It's very depressing news stories there, Charlie. Thanks for that.
Well, just bringing you a dose of reality. That's what we do here at Bloomberg.
Charlie, thanks a lot. Charlie Pellet will be back in just about half hour. So let's get more into the UK inflation story. So overall, consumer prices rose just 10.7% year on year. It's down from the 11.1% we saw in October. Yay, but that's still double digits. And as I was talking about, the food and non-alcoholic beverages rose 16%. That really hurts. And alcohol prices in restaurants and pubs rose a lot. I appreciate that everyone's going to tell me that's not core. But come on. Whiskey, gin, wine, that's core, let's be honest. Let's get more insight here. Bloomberg Economics, Anna Andrade joins us now. Anna, what was your take from the UK inflation number?
Yeah, thanks for having me. So my take from today's CPI print, there's two things I think that were positive news. The first one, as you said, is that we're now seeing that we're past the peak. So we knew that, you know, this inflation would peak in October because of the rise in utility bills. And today we got the confirmation that the peak might be over. And then the second, I would say, is that the data is likely to come as a downside surprise to the Bank of England, just because in their November forecast, forecast, they had expected inflation to be at 10.9%. And so coming at 10.7 will be a downside surprise, which will be kind of relieving.
So, Anna, though, this is one data point, right? This is one data point after a series of data points that showed UK inflation was just ramping up higher and higher and higher. It looks like we're getting a little bit of relief, but we're far from over in terms of the inflation fight, right? Is that really going to change the conversation at the Bank of England into tomorrow's meeting?
I think today's data point definitely helps. I think the MPC was already eyeing into a change of strategy to move from, you know, kind of front loading to kind of smaller hikes for longer. So at its last meeting, it delivered 75 basis points. And now we expect it to deliver 50 basis points. And you're right to say that it's just a data point and that we've had other data points that haven't been so reassuring as wage growth kind of being running at above 6%. But on the whole, it kind of supports the change in strategy. Having said this, the hiking cycle is obviously not over, and inflation will start to come down, but it will be very slowly. So just for you to have an idea, we still expect inflation to be at 9% in March and only end next year at 4%. So clearly there's more hikings to come.
That hurts. So more hikes to come. So can you just help me understand what kind of hiking cycle the BOE is going to have to undergo to get to 7% and then get to 4%? And what of that is just normal comps and sort of the normal economic cycle?
We see a 50 basis point in this meeting, and that's because news have been, well, wage growth is growing at 6%, and then you also have to factor in a little bit of demand boost from the autumn statement. But beyond this, we think that the bank will have enough data or enough evidence to kind of downshift to 25 basis point increases. So we expect 3 25 hikes next year, and the cycle to end in May. And the signs that the Bank of England will be looking for are essentially signs that have started to appear, but they just need to kind of become more pronounced. And that is, vacancies are dropping. So that suggests that the labor market is cooling. Today, in today's CPI, we had services for the first time in 8 months not actually accelerating. So if services have actually also peaked, that's also something that the Bank of England will use to kind of slow down the pace of hiking.
Okay. So the last thing we heard from the Bank of England, they definitely pushed back against market expectations for where the peak rate is going to be, right? This is where rates are ultimately going to end up before perhaps the BOE considers pausing for a while or maybe even considering cutting. But there's some debate over where that peak is. And they were saying that perhaps markets are overestimating where that peak's going to be. But since we've heard from them, it's been kind of a bit of a mixed picture, right, in terms of just the inflationary factors that we've seen out of the UK. And there's some doubt as to whether the BOE was going to have to surpass the peak that they forecast for themselves versus what markets are expecting. So where do we stand on this BOE versus markets debate now?
I think so the BOE has been, you know, coming out of its way to say that rates won't have to go above 4.5 or 4.75%. That's about market pricing right now. And I think it's right. I mean, we see rates going until 4.25% in May. So a little bit above 4, but just below 4.5. And I think if the BOE does go above this, so it enters into this, you know, into this, like they said that 5% is the kind of it's like the psychological threshold for them, because they say that beyond that the UK economy really starts to suffer, and then there's some financial stability risks that, you know, can clearly crystallize. So the BOE doesn't want to go that far. It has kind of that limit, and it still has some space to move until then. But it's unlikely. I think we can take their word a bit for granted.
There was a bunch of stats that came out yesterday that really struck me, and Christine was just mentioning some of it, is that private sector wage growth was higher, but public sector wage growth was just 2.7%, and that inactivity, so people who aren't working or don't want to work, fell by 76%. Labor market, on the one hand, cooling, but the public sector still in like a world of hurt. How does the BOE look at these inputs?
I think the BOE will be mostly concerned about private sector, to be honest. That's where they look at, because that's kind of, you know, that has the power to influence price setting in the economy, whereas, you know, public sector doesn't have marketable output. So there's not really, so, you know, for the economy is obviously painful, and for the public sector workers, obviously painful. But the BOE will be mostly concerned about private sector wage growth. And just on that, the reason why we had wage growth accelerating this time around was actually because of public sector wage growth, which is still, you know, miles below private sector wage growth, but it was the one that accelerated while private sector wage kind of remained broadly unchanged. So that's good news for the BOE.
Okay. And, you know, Anna, you alluded earlier in one of your responses that there's really so much in the way of rate hikes that the UK economy can take at this moment, right? But we haven't even seen the worst of it in terms of the full impact of the cost of living crisis, because at this point in time, yes, energy prices are higher starting in October, but we still have that energy support, or a little bit of energy support from the government. That all goes away at the start of the new fiscal year next year, and that's probably when we start really feeling the full force.
It's April, right? April, March, something like that?
Exactly, yeah. Yes. April, March of next year. And so do you think that the risks are skewed toward the BOE not even getting to that forecast peak of about 4.5% in the interest rates?
I mean, it's definitely a possibility if the pain turns out to be bigger on the UK economy. But I would say that we're actually having signs towards the opposite side. So October GDP was strong. It increased by 0.5%. There was the rebound from the national bank holiday in September. But on the whole, it suggests that we're not really that bad, that, you know, that the cost of living is not yet hitting that bad. Now, I think there's enough reasons to expect, you know, GDP to fall over the next few months, not least even if you factor in the cold snap in December, that's going to weigh on GDP as well. But yeah, there's also some reasons to expect kind of to be relatively shallow. Mm-hmm. One is fiscal support. I mean, you said that, yeah, it's kind of in April, the government, well, in the autumn statement, the government announced support for the most vulnerable households. And that's significant. That was 12 billion. And it also like announced an extension of the cap at the higher level. But still, it will protect consumers from the worst of the energy prices. And if on top of that you look at a labor market that has, it's still very strong, and the excess savings that households accumulating during the pandemic, then you actually have enough reasons to think that, yeah, there will be a recession, there will mm-hmm. be a pain from cost of living crisis and from higher interest rates, but that will be kind of manageable.
And this is where a guy talks about the weather and blah, blah, blah. Let's pretend that happened and move on. Okay, so based on this, and then just getting back to tomorrow real quick, I feel like the BOE central bankers had already sort of diverged a bit from each other in a way that there's more consensus at the Fed and more consensus at the ECB. And the cracks happened earlier with the BOE. How ununited do you think that they're going to be tomorrow?
I think it's going to be a split vote and one of the most ununited votes. So we see three votes for 75 basis points, and that's kind of the usual suspects. So Catherine Mann, Jonathan Askell, and Dave Ramsden. And then we see two votes for 25 basis points and four votes for 50 basis points. We're fairly confident that it will be 50 basis points, but of course the level of the lack of union kind of increases the risks. Because you just need one person to vote or one member to vote for 75 basis points to kind of tip the balance in favor of a bigger hike.
It's going to be fun. I'm actually excited.
Definitely.
All right, Bloomberg economist Anna Arade, thank you so very much. Super appreciate it. Thank you very much for joining us. Christine, I'm interested in that part, but also like where the asymmetric risk is in the market through all these central banks.
Yeah, absolutely, Alex. I mean, when we're talking particularly about the UK, there is definitely a sense of markets heeding that message a little bit from the Bank of England, talking about, again, the fact that they may be overestimating where the rate is ultimately mm-hmm. going to peak. But, you know, as we've seen this in the US, for instance, right, where markets kind of reacted to one single data point thinking, oh, this is it. This is the turning point for the Fed, and we're going to start scaling back those rate hike bets. only to be completely wrong-footed the next time around. And so I think that's what traders are wary of when it comes to UK markets and BOE expectations.
It's going to be fun. And then we get the ECB also. We're going to talk about that next. So there is a conversation evolving that the ECB is actually going to be the most hawkish central bank over the next 48 hours, and that you're going to see some asset divergence because of that, rate differentials, etc. The euro much stronger than the parity that we saw a few months ago. We're going to break that down next. You are listening to The Cable. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson's running to catch a train, so Christina Kino was kind enough to stay even later for me to talk to me now. Let's go to the ECB for a moment. Christine, which central bank are you most excited about? Fed, ECB, or BOE? I won't tell anybody.
I don't know. I don't like playing favorites. I love them all. It's such a hard question.
I'm actually a little bit more excited about the ECB. There is some talk that maybe they're going to be the more hawkish ones. It feels like there's going to be a lot of parsing through in a way that maybe the Fed doesn't have to worry about in the same capacity. So let's get more on this with Bloomberg's ECB editor, Yana Rundau. She joins us now. Yana, you're obviously most excited for the ECB. What are you going to be watching most closely?
So two things that three things that stand out. One, of course, is the interest rate increase, and we're expecting a slowdown there to 50 basis points. The ECB has been very aggressive since July, since liftoff, and we see that a lot of policymakers, if not most of them, have signaled that they would actually prefer a slowdown to 50 basis points. Now that partially has to do with the fact that the hawks really want to get QT going, and so they are willing to compromise there, and that's the second point that we're looking out for. President Lagarde has promised key principles for QT, for how they will reduce the bonds they have accumulated over the years. We're not expecting many details, but certainly some sort of a strategy, a broader strategy, and maybe even some indications as to when that is going to start, probably in the first quarter, second quarter. That would be what most people are expecting. And the third one that's really interesting are the updated economic projections. All eyes will be clearly on where inflation is headed. And the one additional thing, the one additional interesting thing, is that they're adding a year. So we will get a first look at 2025. Now, we know that projections haven't really been all that accurate over the past couple of months, to say the least.
That's kind of nice of you.
but nevertheless, the ECB says they are data dependent. So they're looking at data that's coming in now, and they're looking at forecasts, and it will give them some idea and some reason to argue and back up what they are going to decide.
Yeah, so it's very interesting, Yana. As you mentioned, it seems like the focus for this meeting specifically is really more about that quantitative tightening process, right? How are they going to offload this massive holdings that they have in their balance sheet rather than the rate hikes? Because it feels like the rate hikes, been there, done that. But investors are very curious to know the bond buying, well, how they're going to offload the massive amount of bonds that they bought up over the last decade. Is there potential for that to be more of a bigger policy signal moving forward?
That's something that we've discussed a lot here in the office and with everyone we speak to. And yes, it is super interesting. The ECB has two portfolios, the pandemic portfolio, which is about 1.7 trillion. Reinvestments there are going to continue until the end of 2024, unless the ECB changes its guidance, which I would kindly advise them not. We're focused on the asset purchase program, so the one that has been in place since 2015. That is some 3.3 trillion, and there they're really talking about rolling off some of those bonds. What policymakers have said is that they want to do that process as much in the background as they possibly can. They're looking at it as some sort of a technical operation. They want to put it on autopilot if at all possible. And they've stressed that interest rates remain the main tool, the crucial tool that will actually define their policy. And part of that you can understand, because rolling them off, so basically just letting them expire, is technical. It makes them less less, or puts them at less of a risk of being expected to react to the slightest turmoil that, or the slightest volatility that we see in bond markets as that process gets underway. But of course, you know, after large-scale asset purchases for so long, the market is going to be anxious. They are going to look at this very, very carefully. Mm-hmm. So especially like getting the process started the first couple of months and maybe the first episode of turmoil, that is really where the tricky part is going to be for those policymakers, trying to keep their calm and trying to really judge, are they doing too much? Are they doing too little? And what's going to give them comfort? And we're probably going to hear a lot about that tomorrow as well. Is that they have all these backstops and that mm-hmm. safety net of flexible reinvestments under the PEP program, the pandemic yeah. one, the TPI, the program they created in the summer, right before or right along the first rate hike. So yes, there will be a lot of focus on that, and policymakers will do their utmost to drive that focus away, to say, guys, there's really nothing to see here. We're doing the responsible thing. Mm-hmm. Inflation is what it is. So you focus on the rates, we focus on the rates, and we'll let this go.
Is the market going to be okay with that? Is the market going to listen to that?
Look, so far, we're all very surprised at how well the market is behaving. The president said in October that these key principles would come, which obviously sets the clock ticking and gave some signal that that it won't be too long before, you know, plans turn into reality. And if you look at the market, especially at Italian yields, they've done remarkably well. And the spread over German bonds has narrowed, actually, which, of course, has to do with the fact that the Italian government has been quite responsible in the fiscal policies they implemented. And if that stays that way, there is a good chance that you know, it might be as uneventful as everybody hopes. But we also know very well that crisis can appear in every corner, in every pocket of the market without us expecting them, pretty much from one minute to the next. So there's always that risk.
Mm-hmm. Jana, thanks a lot. I truly appreciate it. A wonderful lead up into tomorrow. Jana Mandel, Bloomberg's ECB editor. I'll just put this out there. Okay, Christine, Bill Dudley was on. He was former New York Fed governor. And he said mm-hmm. the one job he wouldn't want right now would be to be an ECB governor. I'm just saying. When the Fed banker is like, yeah, I don't want that other gig. You know it's rough. It's rough times.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm not jealous of Christine Lagarde either, nope. I have to say.
Or any central bankers right now at this point. Coming up, I am jealous of Rosh Lastein. I'll bring you some of his conversation I have with Guy. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You are listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. It's just past 5:30 over in London. Hopefully you guys are all headed to the pub. Be prepared, though, to pay up for that wine, gin, and whiskey. Christina Kino is joining me in London. Guy Johnson is commuting home within the rail strike trauma. Christine, it's interesting. You take a look at what's happening in the market after yesterday's CPI, and you're seeing equities in the U.S. a bit higher, but honestly, the volume is pretty sad. A little bit of the bid in the front end of the bond market. Oil having a nice rally today, but that's really a bullish forecast by the IEA. We're going to wait and see. It does feel like we're a little coiled headed into the Fed.
Yeah, absolutely, Alex. I mean, I think it feels like a market that is primed more for good news.
Yeah, I agree.
It is determined to see the silver lining after the end of a very long and hard year for a lot of investors, I'm sure. And so that's kind of the setup that we're getting heading into the Fed. And so, you know, in some ways, that kind of raises the potential for disappointment, right? If Powell does come out still very, very hawkish, mm-hmm. despite the fact that they're moderating those rate hikes to 50 basis points now.
Yeah, totally agree. It feels like a little reaction to the good news is where the spring is coiled. But we'll see. All right, we'll get more on that in just a moment. Let's get some other headlines here with Charlie Pellis.
Hi, thank you very much, Alex Steele. Here's what's going on. Train strikes and freezing weather have left London's business districts deserted this week as thousands of financial professionals work from home to avoid disrupted commutes. Office occupancy plunged to just 22% in the capital yesterday, the first official day of the strikes, down from 50%. 51% a week earlier. This according to FreeSpace, which is a workplace company that tracks the data. Even fewer people were at their desks on Monday. While strikes had not yet begun, many trains out of the city were delayed or canceled at the start of the week following a bout of snowfall. UK inflation dipped from a 41-year high in November, raising the possibility that the worst of the cost of living squeeze is over. The Office for National Statistics said consumer prices rose 10.7% from a year earlier, down from 11.1% in October. Economists were expecting a rate of 10.9%. More British students are going to college in America. There were 10,290 UK students attending US universities in the 2021-2022 academic year, according to the Institute of International Education. That is up 28% from the previous year when admissions were hit by the pandemic, 12% higher than a decade ago. Sending kids to Ivy League colleges for prestige and a leg up in the job market, nothing new for affluent British families with international connections. But now consultants say middle-class families with no link to the U.S. and more restrained budgets are also eyeing schools across the pond. Their reasons are varied. Costs have crept up in the U.K. Going to college in the U.S. has started to look better and better to British students. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
That's really fascinating because I also heard that U.S. students are going to Europe, so maybe we're all just going to be a little displaced.
Exactly. That, though, has been a historic trend. I can't tell you the number of friends I have, and no doubt the number of friends you have, who have spent at least one semester studying in the U.K. capital.
Amazingly, nobody that I know.
Seriously?
Well, yeah, but I was a theater person, so they kind of discouraged that because they had like a whole track record of in the freshman year, you study this, and then we move you to this, and you're with the same acting teacher for so many years. They discouraged this.
Could I perhaps suggest that there is no better place in the world to study theater?
I agree.
Than the City of London.
I completely agree with you. It was just, in this particular theater environment, Northwestern, they just did not like that.
They had a very set program.
Yeah, they didn't want you to go to like RADA and all of a sudden come back and be like a different actor that they'd been working with, and they, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. And my next thing I want to do with my life, be an undergraduate at a UK school and not necessarily a top tier college either.
Yeah.
And just have fun.
That's more like what Charlie's going to do.
And actually study something and learn something.
Yeah. I can see that happening. Yeah. All right. Charlie, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it, Charlie Pallett. So, Christine, we were talking a lot about what we think the Fed's going to do. For people putting money into the market, it's kind of a different story. So, a guy and I caught up with Ralph Schlosstein. He's Evercore Chairman Emeritus. He's been in this market for a long time. And we talked to him earlier. We said, you know, how hawkish is Chair Powell going to have to be? This is part of the conversation that we had.
Well, I think you have to understand that if you're the Federal Reserve of the United States, the risks that you confront are asymmetric. The existential threat mistake that any central bank can make is to be viewed as not sufficiently attentive to containing inflation.
Mm-hmm.
That problem was exacerbated by the way the Fed started out with the too long of a clinging to transitory. So their risks, their tolerance for risks is asymmetric. They can't tolerate being viewed as not sufficiently strong on inflation, and they can tolerate the risk that they overcorrect a little bit and cause more unemployment than may be necessary. So I think that I think the market is pretty well set up. I don't expect that this is going to be a surprise in either direction. But if there is a modest surprise, I would expect it to be on assuring the markets that they are vigilant on inflation.
To that point, then, how high are rates going to go and how long do they stay there? That seems to then become the question.
And I think my guess is the committee will be split. And there'll be some in the 4.75 to 5 and some in the 5 to 5.25. My own view is that shows a predilection today, but 100% of what actually happens will be dependent upon the data over the next 2 to 3, 4, 5 months.
Ralph, good morning. It's Guy. The market is pricing that inflation is going to fall and fall fairly rapidly from here. The market is pricing that the Fed is going to cut next year. Do you believe either of those two things?
I believe the first, that the highest probability is that inflation will, it's already starting to fall, and I think there's a lot of evidence that it's going to continue to fall. The things to watch, in my view, are service sector wages and employment, and ex-food and energy CPI. The second question, I think, is a lower probability. My guess is they get to where whatever their destination is, somewhere between 4.75 and 5.25, and if inflation is more persistent, higher than that, and that they sit there for a while because of the point that I made before, that I do believe that their risks, their tolerance for risk is asymmetric.
Ralph, the S&P's up 10%, circa 10%, a little bit below since the last Fed meeting. Fed's not going to be happy with this. Is the market fighting the Fed?
I think the we're in a period of time where I would say the uncertainty about the economy is the greatest that it's been that I can remember. And that's not to say that it's horribly bad. I mean, this is not going to be like 2008. It's not going to be like COVID. But do we go into a recession? Do we go into a mild recession? Or do we go into a little bit more severe recession? Nobody knows the answer to that. And as a consequence, if you look back historically, markets have tended to bottom after the onset of recession. Mm-hmm. So there's a risk that if we do go into a recession, that the markets are a little ahead of the economy.
That was Ralph Schlosstein of Evercore joining us there. We also wanted to talk about Christine about stocks and bonds, and he still likes stocks over bonds, despite the yield or a long-term play.
Very interesting. I mean, mm-hmm. I suppose one argument for stocks is the valuation argument, right? But yields are giving you something now as opposed to nothing just a few years ago.
Exactly. But he still likes it. He thinks there's still a long way to go in the banking system. Things are super clogged. Anyway, talk about clogging. I don't know if I can make this leap. But anyway, the SEC is proposing new changes to retail trades. We're going to get the latest. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele. Christine Aquino is over in London. Okay, so, we're talking FTX? I thought we were talking about the SEC. Can we talk about the SEC too?
I'm here to talk about FTX. I can pretend to talk about the SEC.
Then let's not talk about the SEC. Let's talk about FTX.
Okay,
cool.
Love that.
That was Katie Greifeld, by the way. In my head, we were talking about the rule changes to trading from Gary Gensler, but in reality, we're going to talk about what's next for FTX. So with second day of hearings underway, this time the Senate, Sam Bankman-Fried is trying to fight extradition, potentially. Apparently, he's living in a cell in the Bahamas that has rats and maggots. This is the latest. All right, Katie, what are you watching?
I mean, so in terms of the hearings, I really feel like the showstopper was yesterday with John J. Ray III testifying. Whether anything will actually come out of that, I feel like it was more just a scene setter than anything. You know, as we sort through these federal charges and as the bankruptcy case gets underway, I guess the story and the headlines change constantly, but the storyline that everyone is following today is the fact that Sam Bankman-Fried was denied bail. Remember, his lawyers had suggested $250,000 bail, maybe an ankle bracelet. That was denied. He is sitting in a jail in the Bahamas right now. He's resisting extradition right now, but there's a hearing at February 8th. And I don't know, I've heard various reports, but it sounds like the jail that he's in is not super nice. So,
I mean, I don't think. Is there really any sort of jail that would be considered nice?
House arrest? I mean, I don't know.
But yeah, well, so what do you think, Katie? I mean, this has been quite the saga. Mm-hmm. And it feels like we've gone from a bunch of people either involved in the market or kind of observing from the sidelines, declaring this is the end of crypto, to now very much kind of funneling that focus and, I suppose, a sense of blame, perhaps, specifically on Sam Bankman-Fried, and they've been kind of quick to ring fence that from the rest of the crypto world, which some claim is still very much viable. What are you seeing at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of crypto cranks and skeptics taking victory laps here. Who am I? I'm a journalist, but I don't think it's the end of crypto. And I mean, you look at Bitcoin today, it was over $18,000 a coin, which, you know, doesn't mean anything other than it's rallying right now. But I feel like the fact that Bitcoin has actually up been up 10% or so since we initially got that FTX bankruptcy filing, really drives home the point that what's happening with these crypto companies, this sort of Frankenstein system that was created around the different blockchains, is much different from the actual coins. Nothing went wrong with the Bitcoin blockchain. Nothing went wrong with Bitcoin itself. It's just still a macro asset correlated to stocks, and you're seeing that this week.
But here's my concern now, or a question, is that it seems like everyone in Congress is now actively hateful of crypto.
Like, we have a bipartisan issue. It's
right,
beautiful.
Exactly. Do they make that distinction?
That gets back to the question of who actually regulates this thing. You can have a bunch of angry Congress people. Are they actually going to do anything about it? Maybe it's moved further up the priority list than it was 2 months ago. But we know that they don't exactly move fast. Whether this fast tracks some sort of regulation from the SEC or the CFTC or any of the other letters that are maybe involved here, maybe have some purview here, that remains to be seen. But again, I mean, they also have a hefty to-do list as well.
Yeah, well, this just really seems like the icing on the cake of a very, very hard year for crypto in general and a lot of investors in it. I think moving forward, looking into 2023, what is the sentiment on the ground from both the people who are very much into it and those who are a little bit more skeptical? I mean, are people just kind of wrapping their heads around that this is just how it's going to be, right? You will see periods of volatility, periods of upheaval, whether it's being driven by a specific company or just market volatility in general.
When I talk to investors and my different crypto sources, there's still this sense of just stunned that this even happened. No one's calling the death yet, but it's going to be different.
Yeah, stunned. That's how you want people to be, just stunned. Katie, thanks a lot. I'm glad we got to talk about the topic you're here to talk about. Katie Greifeld joining us on Crypto and FTX. Coming up, oh yeah, we're beating the drum. It is Fed Look Ahead. We're about 1 hour away. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
I think you need to say that we made a little bit of progress, but there's a lot more work ahead. Goods inflation is coming down, but service inflation is still high, and the labor market is still extremely tight. He outlined those three things as things that he was going to be focusing on. So the CPI report helps you on the first part piece, but there's still a lot of work to do, and I think that's what he's going to stress today.
And that was former Federal Reserve Bank of New York President Bill Dudley, who is also a Bloomberg opinion columnist, and talking about the very difficult task that the Fed has ahead of it. I am Christina Kino, of course. I'm stepping in for Guy Johnson this evening and joining the lovely Alex Steele over in New York for The Cable. So, Alex, this is it. Just what, like less of just over an hour now until the Fed decision.
Amazing bringing that in, by the way. This was our first block that she brought in. I was very proud. Doing a wild sod bump in is tricky. Anyway, yep, we got an hour to go. Let's get the preview. Should we do it?
Let's do it.
You do it. You got this.
Yeah, I got this, right? Okay, so, the focus essentially is the fact that it is going to be a moderation in that rate hike from 75 basis points. We got four of those in a row. Now we're getting to 50. And here to break it all down with us, as well as what we're going to be expected to hear from Jay Powell, is none other than Michael McKee, Bloomberg Economics and Policy Editor, who I'm jealous is joining Alex in the New York studio, I believe.
No, he's in D.C., man. He ditches for Fed Week. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mike, wow. What are you expecting? What are you waiting for?
I love Alex, but, you know, it's me and Jay Powell.
It's true.
And I am talking to you from the Federal Reserve, where we are going to be in about 40 minutes getting the decision from the Fed. We're expecting, as you noted, a step back in the pace of rate increases to 50 basis points, which people are taking as something of a dovish sign. But if we had done 50 basis points back in June instead of the first 75 move, people still would have thought that was a very aggressive Fed tightening. So that's something to keep in mind. This is an aggressive Fed, even at 50 basis points. They will probably give us guidance that they're going to raise rates again, but not give us any indication of how many more times, and probably not give us an indication of by how much. They'll also say that we're going to keep rates at the peak for quite some time. John Williams, the president of the New York Fed, has said all through 2023. I don't know if Jay Powell will go that far, but they want to let the markets know that that's going to happen. And then, of course, the interesting thing for everybody on Wall Street is going to be the new economic projections and the dot plot.
Oh, yes, the much-awaited dot plot, right? So, Mike, here's, it seems like this is the dilemma for the Fed, is the fact that, yes, it's going to be a moderation in terms of the size of the rate hike, but they really don't want to be signaling at all to the market that this is any kind of more dovish pivot. But how do they do that exactly?
Well, I think Bill Dudley kind of nailed it when he said the Fed, in the person of Jay Powell, will stress the idea that they have more work to do, that they're not there yet. There was a lot of rejoicing on Wall Street yesterday when we got the CPI report, and everybody was saying, well, gee, that just shows inflation is on its way out, and maybe the Fed will start to pivot. And the Fed's going to say, we don't have permanent evidence of that. It was just 2 months. And we still have a long way to go, because even though inflation came down a lot for the CPI, it was still over 7%. So they're going to stress how far they are from the goal rather than how close we might be to an end to Fed tightening.
What's going to be your question in the presser? For those of you who don't know, Mike goes more towards the end of the question, so all the quote-unquote easy questions have been asked. He acts like the seventh derivative question, and he always gets the best answer, and it's the answer that most of the analysts and economists pick up and then write their notes about. What's your question? Do you know?
I've got a series of questions, because it does depend on when you get called on. But I think what most people want to know is, how far is the Fed away from pausing, if not cutting? And do they think that there will be a cut in interest rates? The dot plot only gives you where the Fed thinks the highest, where they think they're going to be in terms of a Fed funds rate at the end of 2023. And so if they were to raise rates higher and then come back down again, it wouldn't show that. So I think people want to get that view. And then, of course, if I'm dead last and everything else has been answered, I'll ask him who he thinks will win the World Cup.
And then people will write about it, I swear.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I mean, what other Federal Reserve meeting do you think would have featured a World Cup question, right?
Well, what other central bank would have a meeting
exactly
during the World Cup game? I mean,
yeah, it's tough stuff, man. It's tough stuff.
A lot of reporters are going to be sitting in that press conference watching the game, I'm sure.
But I'm sure you're not going to be one of them, right?
No, never.
But Mike, I mean, just taking a look at how markets are reacting right now, right? Even the mere hint of the potential pause here from the Federal Reserve, it seemed like it was really enough to give them a little bit of a cheer. Granted, it's been a very tough year for a lot of investors out there. But do you think markets are kind of wishful thinking right now? Are they overly optimistic that even a pause would be enough to give them a bit of a sigh of relief?
Well, I think if they got a pause, they would be very happy, because they don't like uncertainty, as we heard the cliche so many times. And then they could sort of plan on what their discount is going to be going forward for equity markets. But even if the Fed gave them some idea of where they're going, whether it's a pause or a cut, that could make a big difference. It's not as good for the markets if it's not a cut, but a pause would at least give them some certainty.
Mike, thanks a lot. I know you got to run. Good stuff. We'll be looking forward to that question. Are we rooting for Morocco? Is this what we're doing here?
Are we allowed to root for one or the other?
Yeah, of course. We're not sports journalists. I mean, I always like the underdog story, right? All right, Mike, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. I don't know. I have a panel. I have a conference I have to go to, so I won't be watching. But, I mean, I think I'm rooting for the underdog.
All
right. Do you have strong feelings?
I don't either way. I just like to watch.
She's so nice. This is why we like her. Christine, I appreciate it. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being here with me. Thank you for doing the intro. We always love having you on. So the market waits for the Fed. We're about an hour away. You've been listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. Have a great night, guys. This is Bloomberg.